I've been in the United States now for about 7 years, and I'm now down to only 3 states that I haven't visited, and many of them I have visited on many occasions, and it's been a wonderful experience for me to see how the world's most dynamic economy and most dynamic society actually works. And as an outsider, if I was to make one judgment on Americans, the judgment would be that you don't give yourself credit for some of the very important things that makes Americans different to the rest of the world. And those important things, in my view, are that you are, in my view, the most entrepreneurial people on earth. You are the best people at taking risks. Yet in taking risks, you are also the best at accepting that not all of your bets will pay off, and that when you get to the stage of realizing that this isn't going to succeed, you're the best in the world at deciding, let's can that activity and move to the next one. Except perhaps for your government. I'm fascinated by the fact that this is a conversational evening, and at the end, I get to answer questions. Well, I spent 10 years in New Zealand's Parliament, and one of the neat things about Parliaments is that each day they have something that is called question time. And question time means that if you're a minister, people ask you questions and you're meant to instantaneously have an answer to them. Now, the skill that you learn in that situation, of course, is not to answer the question asked. So one of your challenges is going to be whether or not I actually answered the questions asked. I'm at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and I went there because I could see some things starting to happen in the United States that interested me because they were similar to some of the things that I'd experienced in my own country. And they were that there was a significant change going on in the process of governance, and that that change was going to bring about very extensive shifts in the way in which the machinery of government worked. Yet not too many people were aware of what it was that they had actually instituted at this stage. But what I'm going to do first and foremost is just to trace a little bit of history, because one of my concerns and one of the things that led me to go into politics in my 40s, after having spent most of my year as what you would call a rancher, but we would call a farmer, but it's rude to call somebody a farmer in the United States, so I'll call myself a rancher. Even though I didn't ranch too many animals, I didn't. In the main, I grew crops and things like that. But one of the things that drove me to go into politics was that our government was becoming so invasive that I was concerned, and a number of other people with me were concerned about what kind of a nation would we leave for the next generation, our children, and particularly our grandchildren, if we weren't prepared to do something about it. And as I tour across the United States, I find that that's a driving consideration for many Americans as well. Are you going to leave behind you an America that was as rewarding to you for future generations? And I think it's a very valid question that we each should ask of ourselves. You know, it's only a recent phenomenon that we've experienced big government. From the 1850s until the 1920s or 30s, governments took round about 5 or 6% of GDP for the purposes of governing. But from the 30s and 40s onwards, that exponentially grew, until governments were taking very high proportions of GDP for the purposes of government. Normally couched in terms of, we should make these decisions for you because if you make them for yourself, you're probably going to get them wrong. There's no evidence to say that government did a better job of making those decisions than you would have. But in the case of my country, by the early 80s, the government was taking 44% of GDP for the purposes of governing. And that meant that it wasn't leaving enough for the rest of the economy to create the wealth and the opportunity that we had become accustomed to. In fact, through most of our history, we had been lucky enough to be a relatively wealthy nation. And through until the late 1950s, we ranked somewhere about number three in the world and per capita income, with the United States being number one and Canada being number two. But between the late 1950s and the early 80s, we dropped from being number three in the world to being number 27 in the world, somewhere between Portugal and Turkey. And we had disguised that by having governments that ran deficits for 23 successive years. And of course, if you run deficits for a long period of time, what you do is that you accumulate debt. And by that time, our debt was about 65% of our GDP. Not high by world standards, because if you went to Belgium, you'd find that their debt was somewhere around 186% of their GDP. And if you went to Canada, you'd find that their debt is about 104% of their GDP. But the Canadians are so filthy rich that it doesn't matter. They've got all that wealth buried under the ground that they haven't even touched yet. So the rest of the world doesn't downgrade your credit rating when you have those kind of assets backing you. But they were downgrading our credit rating. And we need to do something about that. One of the responses of governments up until that time was, in New Zealand, was to become more and more invasive in our economy and to do more and more about micromanaging what happened in our economy. For example, we had controls on foreign exchange. So if I wanted to buy a subscription to The Economist magazine, I needed the permission of the Minister of Finance to do so, to free up the foreign exchange dollars to do that. If I wanted to buy shares in a foreign company, about the only way I could do it would have been to surrender my citizenship. If I wanted to increase the prices in my shop or the prices for my services, I never was a lawyer, so I'm not going to say that, but the prices for my services in other fields, I couldn't do so because it was against the law. If I wanted to pay my workers more, I couldn't do that either, because that was against the law. In fact, I couldn't even pay them bonuses, because that also was against the law. So, by comparison, Poland looked like a free and open economy compared to New Zealand in 1984. So, all of those things coming together, we were fortunate in that New Zealand went through an historic period for about 10 years where two successive governments adopted very much the same policy approach. And that policy approach was that we had to restore the nation to the point where it was attractive for our people to stay at home and live in New Zealand, that there were going to be opportunities for them, and that we could pay our way in the world, and that we could trade in the world. In 1984, what the first of those reforming governments did was to recognize that the heart of the problem was too much spending, too much taxing, and too much government. And the solution really was to address those three issues of too much spending, too much taxing, and too much government. The question then is, how do you cut spending and taxes and diminish the government's role in the economy? Because many state governments have probably spent a lot of sleepless nights in the last year or two trying to deal with that issue. And your federal government has dealt with it on many occasions as well, and not always successfully. Well, if you just take a very pragmatic and practical approach to looking at these problems, the first thing that you need to figure out is, what are you getting for the dollars spent? And one of the things that we haven't been able to do in government until very recently has been, we haven't been able to measure just exactly what we get for dollars spent. In fact, in the private sector, we've always been able to say what the bottom line is. It was an improvement in shareholder value. It was an improvement in the equity or the profitability of the company. But they were easily measurable. But in government, what we tended to measure was quantity of activity rather than value of result. Well, around the world at the moment, we're seeing a major wave of change. And that wave of change in about 70 different countries is a movement in government accountability away from an accountability based entirely on how you spent money. Did you spend it in accordance with the appropriation? To a new accountability that says, what benefits did the public get from the expenditure of those tax dollars? Well, that was one of the things that these governments in New Zealand started to focus on. And what they found, when they started to focus very clearly on what benefit arose from the expenditure of tax dollars, was that in many occasions, no benefit whatsoever arose from the expenditure of tax dollars. But even more prevalent was, we don't know. And that was a genuine answer, because there had been no measure of that. Now, when I went into politics because I wanted to see some things get better. Like, I thought that it was wrong that a country that was as wealthy as ours should still have extensive levels of poverty. Why hadn't we been able to fix that? To have extensive levels of hunger. Why hadn't we been able to fix that? To have growing levels year on year for the past 30 years of dependency. Regardless of whether the economy was good or bad, the numbers grew all the time. And the answers were that what we measured was how many people we helped, not whether or not we diminished the problem. And you see, there's a natural phenomenon in politics, and that is that the people in my district come to me and they complain about things. And what they're complaining about, of course, is the consequence of a problem. And what I tend to do as a politician is to do something about relieving the consequence of that problem. So if people are poor, I give them money. But maybe that makes them worse off than not giving them money, but helping them to have the means to earn the money themselves, which is the cause of the problem. And the cause of that problem might be that they're illiterate, that they don't speak the language, that they don't have the skills necessary to get a job, that they have problems of dependency on drugs or alcohol or disabilities. And what those particular government programs didn't do was address those issues. You know, I gave testimony in front of your Congress, Senate, about a year ago, and the subject was the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And one of the things that came up was food stamps. And the person who was responsible for food stamps said to the Senate committee, during the year we were concerned about what was happening with food stamps because the consumption of them was going down. But we really showed some initiative, and we ran major promotional campaigns in every university in the country, and we got the consumption up again. And they said to me, what do you think about that? And I said, well, what I'd like to know is that since 1946, when you first introduced food stamps, as at that time a means of dealing with agricultural surpluses, but later as a means of dealing with hunger, by how much have you diminished hunger? Because the focus of that debate should be on diminishing hunger, not on feeding hungry people. If you just feed a hungry person today, you have to feed them again tomorrow. But dealing with the cause of their hunger is something that deals with their problem permanently. So what we're seeing are governments that are starting to look at what are causing problems and how do we get permanent solutions. That caused us to start to look very critically at some of the government departments themselves and decide whether or not they were actually doing a good job. One of the problems that we had was that nobody was too sure exactly what the job was that they were meant to do. Over the years, they had grown, and sometimes their mission had shifted so that there was no clear view of exactly what it was that they were meant to do. Nor was there any clear view of what it was that the government wanted them to do either. So we started to ask some very fundamental questions, and these questions sound silly, but when you pose them, the answers are extremely interesting. And the first of these questions was, what are you currently doing? Surprising how many agencies couldn't answer that. I strike that here in the United States as well. What are you currently doing? The second question was, does it succeed in eliminating the problem? That got about a 90% don't know answer. And the third question was, what should you be doing? What that led us to do, based on the answers that we got, was to say that we will eliminate all that work that clearly does not work. You see, one of the strange things about government is that when something doesn't work, we give it more money. When something's working well, we give it less money. That would certainly not have succeeded at Walmart. It would not have succeeded anywhere else if you actually think about it. Maybe it's just that you haven't addressed the problem of why it's not working, and it might be worth further investment. But it's not a problem that you can leave unaddressed. That you have to look for, why is this problem, why is this particular policy not working? We work quite closely with your federal government in the work that I do on a day-to-day basis. And one of the key control organizations in your federal government is called the Office of Management and Budget. And the director of the Office of Management and Budget said at a meeting that I was at quite recently, when he was talking about whether programs work or not, and I'd asked him about literacy programs. And he said, the best evidence that we have at the moment is that only about 25% of literacy programs help people to become more literate. Well, if you think about that, if you put the resources of the other 75% into the 25% that work, you would make three times as many people literate as you do today. No new resources. You see, so there's a cost to doing things badly. And the cost is in what we like to think of as the bottom line for government departments. And that is what public benefit arose from these particular activities. Not did you spend the money in the right area, but what public benefit arose from it. Did you manage to diminish hunger? Did you manage to improve entrepreneurship? Did you manage to improve the competitiveness of your community vis-a-vis other communities? Did you manage to lift educational attainment? They're the things that we call outcomes, and much of the focus of government had not been on outcomes, even though as politicians that's what we talked about. But when it came to doing things, we looked at the activities and not the outcomes. So this movement that I'm talking about is focusing very much on moving towards looking at outcomes. That's one of the things that led us to make some of the changes that occurred in the government in New Zealand. And when we asked those questions about what works, what are you doing, what works, and what should you be doing, and we started to apply that to whole government structures, these are the kind of things that happened. When we started to review that process with the Department of Transportation, it had 5,600 employees. When we finished, and we went through and we eliminated all of the things that weren't working and the things that that department shouldn't really be doing, it had 53 employees. When we did exactly the same with the Forest Service, it had 17,000 employees. And by the time we'd finished, it had 17. When we applied that process to the Ministry of Works, it had 28,000 employees. And I used to be their minister. And it finished up that I was the only one left. But the interesting thing about that was that what we were starting to focus on was, say at the Ministry of Works, that what they did was construction and civil engineering. And there were plenty of people in the private sector that did that. And what we were really doing was duplicating their efforts, but in many instances not doing it as well. Now when we shifted that out of the Ministry of Works and put it into the private sector, we got 40% more done for the same kind of work. For the same kind of money. That meant that not only did we absorb all of the 28,000 people we'd laid off from the government, but we employed in that industry another 20% more. You see, now the bottom line for government isn't about, there's nothing special that says that the government's job is to provide work for civil servants. The government's job is to provide services to citizens. The government must be a good employer of its civil servants. In fact, it must rank itself among the very best of employers for its civil servants. But it does not exist to create jobs for them. What it exists is to deliver those services to the citizens. And it should be buying those services from the best providers. By the time we had gone through restructuring government departments and looked right across government, agency by agency, we had been able to reduce the size of government, if you measured it in terms of employees, by 66%. Or if you measured it, which is a more valid measure, in terms of what was government's take of GDP now, it had dropped from 44% down to 27%. In other words, we had halved, or about halved, its take of GDP. And that was just a process of going through very carefully and saying, we're not going to do the things that the government shouldn't do, we're not going to do things that don't work, and we're going to make certain that the current level of service for citizens is maintained. But we're going to do it with the best providers. If I were to look at some other areas of government, it would show that we'd also become involved in many activities that were not appropriate to what government was doing. In fact, we owned things like telephone companies and energy companies and all sorts of activities that really did not belong inside government. So we set about selling off the things that didn't belong there. And they were things like the government printing office, they were insurance companies, they were shipping lines, banks, mortgages, railways, bus services, hotels, shipping lines, agricultural advisory services, and so on. Gradually disposed of all of those. Interestingly, when those things were sold, their productivity went up and the cost of their services to consumers went down. And the range was between 20 to 70%. So the government was not doing people a favour by running these things. Other people could do it much more effectively. But we also looked at many other areas of government and said, are these some of the things that should be able to stand on their own rather than have the taxpayer supporting them? And we found many parts of government where there was a revenue stream attached to them and you could make them operate as viable enterprises. We actually wrote a new law for them, and it was called the State-Owned Enterprises Act. And what it did was to put these organizations into this corporate form, require them by law to be profitable. The only companies in the world that I know that are required by law to be profitable. Not only to be profitable, but to pay taxes and pay dividends as well. I was responsible for about 35 of those organizations at one stage. And where they used to cost our taxpayer about $1,400 million a year, they now return to the taxpayer about $1,200 million a year. a turnaround of just over $3 billion as far as the New Zealand government was concerned. Were the citizens worse off? The answer is no, because the cost of the services went down and the quality of the service went up. What you're looking for really in these instances is what will produce the best result for your citizens. It's not about saying that we need to maintain the size of government. I don't know what's the right size for government. In fact, I don't really care too much about big or small. What I care about is can the government that we've got now produce the best result? And if it can't, can we do it better somewhere else? But let's move aside from that and look at some of the other things like subsidising inefficiency. In our case, the government was really a tragedy of meddling in the marketplace. Because our economy was not very competitive, the government decided that it was necessary to start subsidising different industries, the largest of our industries being agriculture. So they started to subsidise agriculture. Now, there's something sinister about subsidies, because what subsidies do is that they create dependency. And what dependency produces is an inability to be innovative and creative, and for the depth of the dependency to grow year on year. And that's what was happening in my country. By 1984, New Zealand sheep farming was receiving about 44% of its income from the government in the form of subsidies. Its major product was lamb. It was selling that for about $12.50 a carcass, mainly to the poorest markets in the world. The government was providing another $12.50, giving the farmer $25 a carcass. We took all of those subsidies away in a period of 8 months. Naturally, the farming industry was pretty shocked about this. But when they realised that the government was serious, they put together a group of people and they said, what we have to do is find a way of being able to get $30 for this product that we currently get $12.50 for. And that task force came back and it said to them, it's possible, but it's very difficult. You have to produce, for a start, an entirely different animal. It has to be 2.5 times its current size. You have to process it in an entirely different way. And it has to go into the best of the supermarket and restaurant trade in the world. The interesting thing was that was 1989. That was 1987. By 1989, they had their $30 a lamb. By 1991, it was worth $42. By 1994, it was worth $74. By 1999, it was worth $115, with zero input from the government. You see, what that did was that it made farmers go out into the marketplace and say, who will pay the maximum price for this and what do we have to do to get it? You see, if you go into a very nice restaurant in Washington, D.C. and you buy lamb, either as cutlets or some other form, you'll probably pay the equivalent of about $35 a pound for it. The figures that I'm talking about are quite attainable if you're in that marketplace. Not only did we take those subsidies away from farming, we took it away from every other industry as well. The footwear industry had about a 97% tariff on footwear, tariff protection on footwear coming into New Zealand. It made in the main working shoes and boots. It competed with places like Taiwan and China and India. And all of the advice that we got when we took the subsidies and the protection away was that this industry will die. Because it wasn't very big, we sort of accepted that it might die and it wouldn't be too big a loss. Well, you know, today it employs 30% more people than ever before. It produces high fashion shoes and it sells them in the highest priced markets in the world. Because what we had as a natural advantage was good leathers. Now, the interesting thing is that they sell those at between $200 and $300 a pair, where they used to sell working shoes at about $25 to $30 a pair. A 10% margin on $300 is a hell of a lot better than a 10% margin on $35. What you've got, of course, is a skilled workforce that you can afford to pay more now because they're producing a product that has higher value. You see, while the government was in there protecting them, they weren't prepared to take the hard decisions of taking the risk of going into a high price market, maybe getting more in return, but maybe also in some cases being wrong and getting penalised as a result. We went through the whole of the industrial sector of our economy and did that, and the only casualty really has been the car industry. We don't manufacture cars any longer. But with a population of 3 million people, it was pretty stupid to manufacture cars in the first place. And that's one of the reasons why it's not there. It never should have been there. And the only reason it was that it was heavily protected by the government preventing other marketers from getting their cars into the marketplace. The end result being that New Zealand consumers paid about 2.5 times the price of a car that you would have paid at the same time in the United States. That doesn't help your competitiveness. But there were other areas of social policy that needed to be addressed as well. And when I look at things like education, in the early 1980s we were facing the same kind of problems that you have in the United States, that you have a very good system of higher education. You have the best universities in the world, without question. But you've got a problem with primary and secondary education. And the problem is not really that it doesn't do a good job for the very best of students. The problem is that it leaves a large block of students at the moment, at the bottom, without really the skills that they need to participate in society. And our problem was exactly the same. And when we started to look at this, and we certainly weren't the first to look at it, we couldn't figure out exactly what to do. So what we decided we would do first was to look at where do we actually spend the resources? Because the solution that we always got was spend more money. And it produced no better results, but we kept on spending more money. And the answer was, when it came back, that for every dollar we spent on education, 70 cents was consumed in administration and 30 cents got spent inside the classroom. And people were appalled at that figure. They didn't mind paying taxes for education, but they thought it actually got spent on kids. So, to cut a long story short, the problem was that we were over-administered, and you had to get rid of some of that administration. So we abolished all of the education boards and all of the structure that went with them, the whole lot. And what we did was that we placed a board of trustees in control of every school that was elected by the parents of the children at that school. Nobody else got a right to vote, only the parents. And we gave them a block of money that was calculated on counting how many children there are at the school and multiplying it by the number of children that were there. And no strings attached. They had to write a charter with their local community in terms of what reasonable expectations could be of the education that would come out of this school. We also conducted another debate at the same time, because like you, we told parents where you sent your child to school. And this second debate was asking the question about, does the government have the right to send your child to a bad school? And the answer obviously came back, no. Does anybody have the right to tell you where your child will go to school? The answer to that also was no. So we gave parents the right to choose. You could choose where your child went to school. But at the same time, we were thinking about a government that actually doesn't run institutions, but it buys goods and services from the best providers. So we made no difference between whether you sent your child to a private school or a public school. You could choose. Now here's the interesting thing. By the time that had been in place for about 30 months, the difference in educational attainment between private schools and public schools had disappeared. Because what you really had was competition for students. And competition for students meant that if students left your particular school, and it only took about 5, you put a teaching position at risk. And then the teachers in the common room said, who the hell lost those kids? Because they better be the first one to go. And that meant that people started to take action on what was going wrong in terms of not being able to educate kids. We started off in 1984 being about 15% behind our international peers in terms of educational achievement. Within 3 years, we were about 15% ahead of them. And those were the only two changes that we made. But that change of getting rid of that bureaucracy meant that we were able to reverse that equation. We were now able to put 66% of every tax dollar inside the classroom. It meant that we were able to see that there was at least one computer for every three students, that there were no arrears of maintenance, that every new school that needed to be built was built, that there were no more than 20 students in any classroom with one teacher. And we used not $1 more, just a better allocation of resource. If I was a politician here, I'd be making a big thing of saying, I'm going to get more of every education dollar spent on kids inside the classroom, and then go out and try to do something about it. You know, it's not even that difficult to do, because people say to me, how could you possibly make a change like that? Didn't the education unions give you a bad time? The answer was initially yes, but there are more parents than there are teachers. And parents have more votes than teachers have. And parents like the idea of having control of their schools. And not only did they like it, they were actually good at it as well. I told the story to Jim at lunchtime today, but one of the best schools in the country was in one of the most economically deprived areas of Auckland City, our biggest city. 5 miles away was the wealthiest suburb in New Zealand, a place called Remuera. There were people in Remuera who were busing their children from Remuera to this school in Otaki because it was better. Now, isn't that a reversal? Quite the reverse of what everybody would tell you, that schools in these areas won't be able to succeed. For our native Maori people, it was a huge success, because now the Board of Trustees had the opportunity to be able to give some special character to their schools. And they did that by seeing that outside of the core curriculum which they had to teach, they were able to specialise in Maori language, in Maori culture, in Maori song and dance and all of those things, making them proud of their heritage so that they started to drop off in terms of their incidents in the roles of those who were incarcerated and things like that. Could you do that with a bureaucracy? In my view, not a chance in hell. You can only do that when you have that local input. Could I just give you one other thing about that? You know, when our schools were great, whether it's here in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, who ran them? Parents ran them. When schools started, they were run by parents. Who has the greatest interest in the success of schools? Parents. So why did we disenfranchise them? No good reason. But also, no good reason to reverse it. One of the other things that we found that was interesting was in looking at some of the things that were creating problems for society as a whole. And what we really found was that the law itself was often at fault. That the law was archaic. That it had been written 140 years ago. It had been amended many times, but it was now confusing. So we did something that people thought was impossible, and that was that we rewrote a number of the statutes. Just start from scratch. And did it on the basis of saying, let's get our brightest brains together and say to them, just pretend there is now no law. Write the best possible law for contemporary society today and see what that looks like. One of the ones that we did was to rewrite environmental law, because when we looked at that, Our statutes measured about 32 inches. They were frequently contradictory. They were impossible for citizens to be able to comply with. It took us 2.5 years to go through the consultative process and everything like that. But there's now something that's called the Resource Management Act. It has 340 pages to it, and all of the other has been repealed. It's very easy to understand now. It's very easy to get at the principles, and it's much more difficult to be wrongly convicted of something because of confusion. We didn't do it just with that law. We did it with most of the laws. Because if you've got bad regulations, I have never seen any government anywhere that's been successful at permanently killing regulations. They just keep growing faster than you can kill them. We do a study at the university where I am at the end of each presidential term and look at midnight regulations. And we measure them in terms of the thousands of new pages of regulations that come in. At the end of the Clinton administration, there was 29,000 new pages of regulations that were to be approved within the last days of that administration. Not over the whole 8 years, just the last few days. Well, the best way to kill them is to write a new statute, because when you repeal the old, all of the regulations die. The whole lot. And that was a pretty neat trick. Here's just a couple of things that are about thinking differently about the way government does things, and I'm just about finished. And that fresh thinking is starting to think in terms of, well, if what we've done in the past doesn't solve the problem, what might we do in the future that would? And this is just a neat little story, but New Zealand as a country never had any large animals. And when the British first came, they wanted to be able to hunt like they had at home. So they brought deer with them. And they released these deer, and gradually they populated, and they populated our forests. And from that point onwards, they were a major pest. And every year we spent millions trying to eliminate them or keep them under control. And we never succeeded. Until about 1980, somebody made a smart decision and they said, why don't we just let farmers farm them and sell the meat? Well, that was a pretty radical idea. Now, you know, those farmers went out there, they had to build high fences and that on their properties, but they went out there and they caught those darn deer, just about every single one of them. I've actually seen a guy jump off a helicopter about 40 feet in the air, onto the back of a deer, wrestle it to the ground, and tie its legs together like you see at the stampedes. Now, this is something that falls into the category of please don't try this at home. But why would they do that? Because overnight, a hind had moved from having zero value to 7,500. On a good day, you could capture up to 20 hinds. It was good money. The end result is that from that day onwards, we have never, as a government, spent a dollar on eradicating deer. But we now supply 40% of the world's venison market. And we have created a whole industry that has given farmers other options than those that they had previously. All by just making a different decision. Now, in the United States, you have a different process for keeping deer populations down. You run over them with your cars. It has limited success, a significant level of risk, and not much financial reward. Part of what we do where I am now at the Makeda Center is actually to start looking at how some of these things might apply in the United States. And your federal government passed a law in 1993 called the Government Performance and Results Act. The thing that was important about that law was that it required bureaucracies to start to identify what public benefit flowed from the expenditure of the monies that they make. So that's stage one. That's sort of, let's find out what we actually get. The next stage was that President Bush passed an administrative order which was called the President's Management Agenda, and that requires that the federal government prepare budgets on the basis of them being performance budgets. And that means that agencies now have to put beside their budget request the evidence of last year's performance. And that's starting to raise questions about whether programs actually work. In the early stages of that, of course, nobody knew. And the Office of Management and Budgets started to review programs to see just exactly whether or not they were effective. What they got was that 67% of programs in the first year that they reviewed them were unable to demonstrate that they had any effect at all. 7% showed that they were effective. 11% showed that they were ineffective. Congress reversed the order on eliminating the ineffective programs, so you're still paying for them. We did a study and we looked at, just to try and demonstrate the value of looking at things on the basis of what works, and we looked at vocational training programs. The federal government had 178 programs that are designed one way or another to help get people back into the workforce. But when we thinned out those programs down to those that had some relationship in any form whatsoever to vocational training, we found about 45 of them. And you spend $8.4 billion on them. And as a result, you get 2.4 million people into work. They cost per person placed into work between $500, $573 a person at the low end, to $29,783 at the high end, per person placed into work. That's not the most successful program, incidentally. Then we asked the question, what would happen if you put these resources into the most successful programs? And the answer is you wouldn't get 2.4 million people into work. You would get 14.7 million people into work. Something like a sevenfold gain. Or, if you looked at it another way, you could say, how could we maintain the current public benefit of 2.4 million people into work? If you funded the best programs, you could do that and still have $6 billion left over to spend somewhere else. What we're talking about are very powerful forces that start to look at how can we use resources better based upon information about their effectiveness. It's what got New Zealand out of the woods. It's what I see happening in a lot of the developing economies out of Eastern Europe. But there are still places like France and Germany in some parts of the United States that haven't learned these lessons yet. And what we're trying to do is to help them learn these lessons. Thank you, everybody. It's been a pleasure to be with you and be able to speak to you tonight.